Now, are you ready? All right, let's turn together to 84A. 84A. And we'll be singing, watch it now. We'll be singing the first four stanzas. 84A. I pray that with all the wrong things and disagreeable things and wicked things even, you would still have this attitude towards God's house. How lovely, Lord of hosts, to me, the tabernacles of thy grace. How I long, ye faint, to see Jehovah's courts, his dwelling place. There have been those times when the courts that people call Jehovah's courts were not God's dwelling place. So what's your prayer? That they would be Jehovah's dwelling place. And when you love God's house, then you want what is best for it, and he being there in it. And then the second stanza applies to the ladies also as well as the men. The sparrow finds her place of rest. The swallow, through thy kindly care, is found where she may build her nest. I'm sure that in the temple of Jerusalem, there were, as there can be yet today, birds. Not the temple there, but there's the mosque there. And we had a bird in our new room just the other day. And birds will fly in and out. And when you go in and out of the cathedrals in Europe, you need to be careful about where you sit down. And the birds do fly in and out of there. But you will find that they're nesting there. She finds a place where she may rear her young in safety there. And many a mother and father have found a place where they could rear their young in safety there in God's house, among God's fellowship with other tribes that have gone up to his house together. I keep watching what I know is true in other congregations also, that this parking lot looks more like a van parking lot. As the families pull in, the tribes pull in, and they live together there. How lovely, Lord of hosts, to me the tabernacles of thy grace. Oh, how I long, yea, faint, to see Jehovah's courts, his dwelling place. My heart and flesh with joy draw nigh, as to the living God I cry. Sometimes you have to look very closely. Just as Dr. Gerson was saying last evening, where is the church? Where is it? If you have all this other stuff that's going on, where is the church? You have to look very closely sometimes to find it. But you do find it. And then what I was saying a minute ago about how families find that this is a place where they can rear their young. The sparrow has her place of rest. The swallow, through thy kindly care, has found where she may build her nest and brood her young in safety there. Thine altars as my rest I sing, O Lord of hosts, my God, my King. Blessed they who in thy house abide, to thee they ever render praise. Blessed they who in thy strength confide, and in whose heart are pilgrims' ways. They make the veil of tears a spring, with showers of blessings covering. Advancing still from strength to strength, they go where
till each to Zion comes at length and stands before the face of God. Lord God of hosts, my pleading hear. O Israel, draw to me, give ear.
Jacob, Israel. I'm sorry, I went off on a wrong tune there at the end of that other stanza. But it's a beautiful psalm, and it bespeaks God's house, the fellowship of His people, as they gather themselves together and have from the days of the Garden of Eden straight on down through to today. Men began to call upon the name of the Lord there and then. Let's look for just a minute in 1 Samuel chapter 8. 1 Samuel chapter 8. A little bit of a sad story here in 1 Samuel chapter 8. Anyone need a Bible? We probably can find a couple of others. You have one other one back there too. I'm sorry, I meant to find. There might be one up here. Here's some. Anybody else want one? Thank you. Thank you. All right. 1 Samuel chapter 8. It came to pass when Samuel was old that he made his sons judges over Israel. Now the name of his firstborn was Joel, the name of his second Abiah. They were judges in Beersheba. And his sons walked not in his ways, but turned aside after lucre and took bribes and perverted judgment. Then all the elders of Israel gathered themselves together and came to Samuel unto Ramah and said unto him, Behold, thou art old, and thy sons walk not in thy ways. Now make us a king to judge us, like all the nations. But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, Give us a king to judge us. And Samuel prayed unto the Lord. The Lord said unto Samuel, Hearken unto the voice of the people in all that they say unto thee. For they have not rejected thee, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them, according to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even unto this day, wherewith they have forsaken me and served other gods, so do they also unto thee. Now therefore hearken unto their voice, howbeit yet protest solemnly unto them, and show them the manner of the king that shall reign over them. And Samuel told all the words of the Lord unto the people that asked of him a king. And he said, This will be the manner of the king that shall reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for himself, for his chariots, and to be his horsemen. And some shall run before his chariots. And he will appoint him captains over thousands and captains over fifties, and will set them to ear his ground, and to reap his harvest, and to make his instruments of war, and instruments of his chariots. And he will take your daughters to be his confectionaries, and to be cooks, and to be bakers. And he will take your fields and your vineyards and your olive yards, even the best of them, and give them to his servants. And he will take the tenth of your seed and of your vineyards and give to his officers and to his servants. And he will take your men servants and your maid servants and your goodliest among men, young men, and your asses, and put them to his work. He will take the tenth of your sheep, and ye shall be his servants. And ye shall cry out in that day because of your king, which ye shall have chosen you. And the Lord will not hear you in that day. Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, Nay, but we will have a king over us, that we may also be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. And Samuel heard all the words of the people, and he rehearsed them in the ears of the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, "Hearken unto their voice, make them a king." And Samuel said unto the men of Israel, "Go ye every man unto his city." And in the next chapter, God gave him a king. They're determined to have a king. They want to be like the Joneses, like all the other nations around us. So in the next chapter, I'm sure that God had a smile on his face. Because here's this man who was head and shoulders taller than everybody else in the whole nation. What's his name? King Saul. He became king. He's head and shoulders taller than everybody else. And he's out on an errand for his dad. He's looking for his dad's asses. You look at the captor carefully, you find he never found him. He never found him. So you see, I just show there's a smile on God's face. These people are determined to have a king that'll lead them. All right, give him a king. There he goes. Big, broad-shouldered man, tall, he can't even find his dad's ass. They're the people. He's the man. I'm sure there's a little bit of a smile on God's face as he points them to the one. And King Saul didn't turn out very well, you remember. You have to put these chapters together and keep an eye on them. Because it's the overall picture, just as you continued singing right straight through that psalm in order to catch more of the significance of the entire chapter. And please do that in your reading of Scripture. Now we're going to be talking not so much about the selection of kings, although that will be a subject this evening, as we are talking about the selection of someone to be the head of the church this evening, the papacy. And I believe that God may very well have said to them, you want somebody to head the church instead of me? Okay, go ahead. Look out for what you're going to get. And we're going to see in history, the chapters of history, medieval history, something what happens when people begin selecting someone to be the head of the church, someone who is not really Jesus the Christ. Now, the quiz. The Waldensians, or Waldenses, however you want to spell it, were a group of people arising in the 12th century who preached a simple, primitive form of the New Testament message and were forerunners of the Reformation. The Waldenses, the Waldensians, and we will get into some more concerning them a little bit later on, Peter Waldo and his history. But that really is Reformation history. The medieval history revolves around the emperor and the pope. That's it. Now, if you have written down there monasteries, that's all right, too. But it probably is the emperor and the pope, to use two people. Who was called the Apostle of Germany? Who was that?
Boniface.
Been called the Apostle of Germany. Please don't miss that one. That's important for you to know. And we spent a little bit of time talking about what he did. Remember, he was the man who took off his archbishopric robes toward the end of his life, at the very end of his life, as a matter of fact. That's what made it the end of his life. Because there was one section of Germany that had not responded to the gospel when he went through there years and years earlier as a younger man. And he took off his robes and he went back with a small group of people to evangelize that part of the world. And he did evangelize. And they killed him because of it. And then you know what? The Roman Catholic Church refused to have anything to do with him because it said he was too Protestant. The Protestant Church refused to have anything to do with him because it said he was too Roman Catholic. And so that means that God's going to have to make the final decision. Isn't that great?
Did you ever see a biography about him?
Did I what?
See a biography about him?
I never did. There must be.
I looked in the library the other day, and there wasn't.
You didn't find any?
But there's got to be.
Please pursue what Brad's talking about here. You people know how to study character. And that's well worth studying. But you can know because the Roman Catholics were shooting as much at him from this side as the Protestants were from this side, that maybe he was exactly right. That could be it. The Holy Roman Empire was in existence from approximately what AD? 800 to 1,500 is exactly right. If you have 1,800, you're a little too late. Did you say 1,800?
I've read that. I can't remember if it was Schaff or when Napoleon broke up the Austrian Empire. If you're a real Empire fan, maybe you want to keep it going until 1,800.
Okay.
I put down 1,500 as your date, but I think I have to agree that it was around 1817, something like that, where the German Empire took over.
And
maybe
what?
It's a matter of definition.
What was the Kaiser? What's the other name for the Kaiser? What's his name mean?
Caesar.
Kaiser. Yeah, excuse me.
The problem with breaking it up in 1,500 is it does kind of have. Still there during the Reformation. It's having its impact, but it's also
splintering. So. Robert, that is scratch your ear around here and you buy a piano, it's like at an auction. Be careful. the thing is, a movement was set free and it did go on beyond any time limits. See, I could get very hard-nosed at this point and say, but wait a minute, that doesn't fit in my division of time limits. and you'd say, that's right, Roy. And I don't find your time limits in Scripture, and you're right. You need to know these dates and be careful of them, but don't lock them into my time limits. Garden of Eden to the year 100. Well, year 0 or 100 is pretty well fixed. But year 100 to 590... that's pretty arbitrary. The year 590 to the year 1390, beginning of the Reformation, 1390 to 1690. How do you derive 1690 as the end of the Reformation period? Well, that's pretty hard to do. And those of you who are in the class last semester know that I spent one whole lecture talking about the problems that arise when you pigeonhole history into... it had to fit between this date and this date. And so then we cut these things off and cut these things off in order to get them fitted into our history frame. And they didn't begin here and they didn't end here, just as you're saying here. It did carry on over. So please keep thinking that way, but at the same time, know some of these dates. So good. Check the factors below that strengthened the papacy and the establishment of the Holy Roman Empire, which we discussed last week. What was one of the things? Okay.
Land donations to the Pope.
Incidentally, who was it supposed to have given these land donations to the Pope originally?
Constantine.
And what's another one that strengthened the papacy?
Crown accepted from the Pope.
Yes, the crown accepted from the Pope. What's another one?
I am fighting with the Turks because it isolated the East.
Well, visits to Rome were more important than that.
Really, all four, right, Roy?
You could get out of all four, yes. The one that I did not have checked was fighting with the Turks. The establishment of the Holy Roman Empire, the popes did not do much as far as fighting the Turks were concerned. The Turks would have taken over if you'd left it up to the popes and the Church of Rome.
Wasn't that a fundraising situation, though?
That they gave money in order to raise...
in order to defend against the Turks, didn't that become a major motivation for people to give?
There was some giving there, yes.
I was thinking that the way the Turks were a threat kind of pushed the papacy and the Holy Roman Empire. They needed each other to...
oh. Yeah, there was a remarkable failure. It was the Eastern Church, Constantinople, that was really under threat from the Turks. And the Western Church and the Eastern Church could not even get together over this common enemy. And there's at least one of the popes who did business with the Turks. And that wasn't a common practice. But there was at least one of them who, in order to promote his particular purposes, did business with the Turks. But grade yourself liberally on that. Match the person with the appropriate title. Charles the Great was Charlemagne. Augustine was the missionary to Britain. Aidan was the apostle of Northumbria. Gregory the Great, he struggled with that title of Patriarch of Patriarchs and deliberately rejected it. So if you put J in there, give yourself full credit. I don't know of any place else that Gregory the Great would go. But he insisted to the Patriarch of Constantinople. When the Patriarch of Constantinople called him the Patriarch of Patriarchs. And one of the other patriarchs also called him Patriarch of... He insisted that he was not that. But that's the one that you could put in there. Muhammad is a prophet of Allah. St. Patrick is a missionary to Ireland. Columbanus was a missionary to Germany. Boniface was apostle of Germany. That comes in twice in this quiz. And Pepin is the king of the Franks. And Charles V is the new Constantine. All right, give yourself, grade your paper, please, and pass that in to the center. And then if somebody would help pick that up, I'd appreciate it very much.
What event is it? Charles V's ascension to the throne in 1500, was that the event that you're using to terminate the Holy Roman Empire? Think into a multi-manic empire? I'm curious as to your defense of that, David.
I don't mean to defend it very seriously.
You were right. I'd like to hear it.
Well, that's about it. That's about it.
Approximately as the key.
They could.
Approximately.
Yeah. The word approximate is in there. Yeah. It's not a very good reason, Tom.
Well, you could say, though, in the 1500s, you remember that Luther film, that the Reformation broke the empire apart because the emperor literally could not enforce what the Roman Catholic Church wanted him to put. He couldn't do it politically and militarily. He did not have the will or the army to go around and say, everyone's going to be Catholic now. So, in essence, that's the end of the empire if you can't.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the President of the United States, if he can't make people do things, he's not really president anymore. That's the beginning and end when you lose your authority.
And Luther is a good case in point, as we'll find out in the Reformation, because Luther never quite knew where the attack was coming from. Was it coming from the emperor? Was it coming from the pope? When he went down there on trial, who was he on trial before? Who was holding him on trial? And he could have been blindsided. Who was his enemy? Who was the point of the attack there? Yeah. I want to... want to give you a couple of announcements this evening, and the first of these has to do with the Reformed Presbyterian Summer Institute. I have had two faxes from Andrew Quigley, and Andrew Quigley will be over here in March. He will be up in Lafayette as well as down here, and he will be interviewing the congregations. Andrew Quigley is the pastor of the Airdrie Reformed Presbyterian Congregation in Airdrie, Scotland. He works very closely with a man named David Fallows, who is the pastor of the Wishaw Reformed Presbyterian Church. Both these churches are close to Glasgow, about 20 minutes apart. They are the two most live churches in the Reformed Presbyterian Church in Scotland today. They are working very closely with Harold Milligan down in Stranraer in the southwest corner of Scotland. all three of these men come from Ireland, but they are pastors in the Reformed Presbyterian Church in Scotland right now. These two men, Quigley and Fallows, are brothers-in-law. And when they were going through seminary in Ireland, they had quite a thing going, because for a long time the Reformed Presbyterian Church in North Ireland had a mission down in South Ireland. And now in South Ireland, there are the most of the communities are 99% Roman Catholic. And so when they reformed the Reformation Presbyterian Church goes into South Ireland, some very exciting things happened. I can remember preaching on the street in Galway, South Ireland. And there were people from the young people from Australia, and young people from America, and young people from Scotland, and young people from North Ireland on the microphone there on the street, and it was catching the people by surprise. They were sort of blindsided, because by the time they made out what one accent was, there was another one up there sharing testimony, and so many people were very much interested in the gospel. And there was lots of good results from that. But these two, that movement gradually died down among the youth of the Church of North Ireland. And so these two men who were going to become brothers-in-law, they weren't at that time, got together and set up another youth program, which is still going on in Ireland today. And it was a tremendous thing. And God is blessing the ministry of the youth over there in North Ireland. But it's a holdover from these two fellows when they were working together in seminary. Now they're no longer in seminary, and they married sisters, and they're pastors in Scotland. And that's a little bit of the background, because this man Quigley had heard about the ministries in Lafayette and North and South Side Indianapolis and Columbus and some other places here in Indiana. And he said, I want to see that, but I don't have the money to go over there and see that. And so I put it to the session of Second RP, and they said, "Well, we'll see to it that he gets over here." And so he's coming over in March, and he's doing already a study program that we laid out for him, he will have a set of questions that he is addressing to each one of the congregations, and. I've assured him that there are many things that are similar to the ministry of these churches here in central Indiana to what the Reformed Presbyterian churches were doing in Scotland back between 1743 and 1862 or 3, when the church was growing so rapidly. They grew from one congregation to, 30 or 40 congregations, and they grew from one presbytery to two to three to four, and formed a synod all during that brief period of time. They were growing at a tremendous rate. And Quigley knew a little bit about this, but he was able to see a similarity between what God had done with the church in Scotland over there during those years and what God is doing with the Reformed Presbyterian Church in Indiana today. He is seeing that. And one of his other assignments is to get with Keith McGill and find out what the program of the Church Extension Commission is for the Synod of the Reformed Presbyterian Church of North America. And he desires that there would be a multiplying ministry of congregations back over there in Scotland. And his sidekick, his brother-in-law, and his friend also from down there in Stranraer are looking forward to his bringing report back with them. That maybe there'd be some things here that could be useful to them over there. But he's coming over here in March or April. He has gone ahead to set up a Reformed Presbyterian Summer Institute. This will be, and if somebody could help Heather pass these out, this will be headquartered at a place called Biggar, B-I-G-G-A-R, south of Edinburgh, Scotland, about 50 miles or 60 miles, is it, Robert? 50 or 60, something like that. And conference ground. It's not a conference grounds. What do you call that over there, Robert?
Conference center.
And what's the name of it?
Maranatha.
Maranatha. Conference Center in Bigger. It's a Christian conference center. And there is a, help me, somebody. The boy who went over from seminary last year from Pittsburgh.
Matt Philbert.
Matt Philbert is going back over next summer with, I don't know how many, 10, 15 people again next summer. And Quigley was one of the ones who hosted that group from America last summer. And they had such good results that they encouraged him to come back again next summer. And this time they want to make a study tour out of it, a study mission tour, or a study travel tour. And we've been on the telephone, and we've estimated or guesstimated that there might be as many as 20 who would be coming from this congregation and anyone else from the other congregations around here who would like to go. And with the 15 or 20 that Matthew would be taking over, Matt Philbert, that would be 40 or so. And then he said, and this is important, so listen a minute. There will be some young people, probably seminarians, from the seminary in Ireland, Reformed Presbyterian Theological Hall, I call it, in Ireland. Dr. Mackay will be another one of those lecturing over there. Dr. Mackay is a fascinating man who has just finished his doctorate in a study of George Gillespie and his theology and contribution to the church, one of the Westminster Assembly men. And he's teaching there at the seminary in Belfast. And so there could be, Robert said to him right away over the phone, we were talking with him on the phone from up here last week, how many will a center hold? And he knew what we'd already known, because when we were over there last summer, Robert and Beth and Margie and I had visited that same center in Bigger, and it holds about 60. But they will provide not only overnight accommodations for us, and it's very nice accommodations, they will provide bed and breakfast. That is, you get your breakfast the next morning. That's Scottish breakfast, folks. It sticks to your ribs, even oatmeal, but it's not just oatmeal. But they also provide dinner, bed and breakfast. And they provide not only dinner, bed and breakfast, but they'll pack the lunches for the study tours that we'll be taking during the day. So the morning will be, as you have it here, with lectures. And the afternoon will be with going out to these various places to see where these people had lived and worked and died, and learning that there. Now, the dates are negotiable to some extent, but we're going to have to zero in on these dates very quickly in order to get the best tickets. And they've already negotiated a tremendous deal, better than any we could, because they're coming up with a price for dinner, bed, breakfast, noon lunch, and transportation vans. If we have smaller vans, we can get closer to these places where we have to go. The big buses won't go out into the field or into the barnyard and park, so we can walk on up there. But the vans can. And there's a lot of things that have to be worked out on this yet. Heather's working hard at getting the transportation costs identified quickly. And it looks to us at this point, didn't we say, Robert, there'd be about $1,500, including, that includes airfare. And part of the reason for that is because they've been able to negotiate such an excellent price. When we were there at the conference center, we happened to notice that they did have rates for educational groups. Well, this will qualify for an educational group. As a matter of fact, I could see where there would be a seminary-level credit granted when several of our students have gone to the Theological Hall in Ireland, and they came back. They were given credit, academic credit, at the seminary for the work that they took over there. My son was one of those, when he was finishing his second year in seminary, he said, "Dad, what should I do next?" I said, "Why don't you get a little broader base? Why don't you go over to Ireland and see how they teach over there?" One of the things I like about the teachers over there, and this is true of Dr. Mackay, is that every one of the teachers in the seminary are pastors. Their primary assignment is pastoring. But then they teach church history and systematic theology and Hebrew and Old Testament and New Testament and other things. They teach these in addition to being pastors. Dr. Mackay is the pastor of the same church that I preached in Belfast when I was over there. I was a stated supply pastor for that church in Belfast, the Craig Road Church. And so he's not losing his grip as far as his professional, as a pastor is concerned. And it reminds me a little bit of what happened to us on board when we were learning to fly in the Navy. The Navy would take some of her best combat pilots and take them out of the actual combat and bring them back to teach us cadets. And those combat pilots had a way of meaning business. And I've heard them say, "Now you either learn to fly or you'll die. And we don't have time for people who are going to die. So here's how you fly." And they sort of wipe their swords off and lay them down on the table Monday morning and begin teaching the cadets. And I've seen that take place with the teachers at the seminary there in Belfast. And they've deliberately made it a policy to go that route. This is the way they teach. And it's good. It's good for the cadets, for all of us. I wanted you to know about this while it's still in the planning stages. Yes? Not that I know of at this point. We've not received any word about any tuition costs in addition to the $1,500. And we're just guesstimating $1,500 because part of that they didn't even know about. We told them over the phone what the airfare would be round trip. And then when we added that together, we came up with $1,500. Andrew Quigley said, "Roy, I need to tell you this. I've invited my father," who's in Ireland, of course, "I've invited my father to be here for the Summer Institute." He said, "He's not going to want to take this as a seminary-level class. He's just going to be sitting in on the classes." I said, "What you're telling me then is that there will be those there in the classes who will be auditing." He says, "Well, that's the word you use in America." I said, "Yes. They won't be there taking the test and so forth. They'll be there auditing the class." Yes? They're on the page here. Monday, the 22nd of June, through to Thursday, the 2nd of July.
Or I had originally had kind of touring separate from the institute or before.
Yes.
I
don't know, and this is why I say I'm letting you in on the ground floor of the planning, because I didn't even have the word institute in there before. It was just that there would be lectures, but he has gone ahead independently of that to draw up this form, and I have to see in it that the same Lord that was working in our lives is working in His. And how this is finally going to work out, I don't know. But I wanted you in on it to begin with. And these dates, this is why I said these dates are not locked in cement. But this is the time that fits their schedule over there because school is out over there in the about the 1st of June or middle of June, Robert?
End of June.
And then it begins again in July. So that's what they're thinking about for them. But I would expect, I don't know how that's going to work out. I just wanted you to know that we've just gotten this fax from him. And if you have input and suggestions on this, please let us know. Now I've got two hands here. Tom?
One suggestion, one comment. It'd be nice if we could honor the Sabbath.
Yes.
Which we could not do, at least on the Israel tour I was on, both in regards to travel and... Do you need a response from us on this yet?
No, I don't. We're not ready for responses yet. We will be putting out a form, an application form, which will have, as a bottom line, what do you call it, earnest money or down payment or something, before very long, though. That'll be coming up before very long. As far as the honoring of the Sabbath is concerned, the last day that you can get the bottom rate ticket for a flight over there is a Thursday. If you buy a ticket for Friday, then it costs more. That means that you would be traveling Friday, and it takes one day, so you'd be over there Saturday, which means you could rest. And I would pray that, Tom, how do you lead singing? I would pray that we could be blessing to the various congregations over there. Beg pardon? You'll bring your pitch pipe. All right, there you go. And I would pray that we could do that. And again, you have no idea what a blessing you can be as they see that there are young people in the church. And there are a few young people, but very few. And I believe that we could get to Stranraer and to Wishaw and Airdrie. I think we can be in both the Wishaw and Airdrie congregations in some one day. Andrew Quigley wants to plan these afternoon tours. He wants to plan them, and he did plan many of these for last year. We're not limited to traveling with him and with the others on those. We can make our own plans if we want. But I think it might be a good thing for us to meet people from the other church and do some work with them, people from Ireland as well as here. Then coming back, we would need to schedule our flight back. It could be Monday. Is there a higher flight for Monday?
No, Monday is a good day.
Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday are the days that you have to book in order to get the low flights. This June date is about $150 more than what it would cost if we scheduled out the end of May. There are some who are going to have a problem with the first week in June. And we're going to have to be careful about that one. Any questions? Any others? I knew this would take a little bit of time. I wanted you to start thinking and to know everything we know. I'm looking forward to meeting Quigley and talking through with him about where it is that he has in mind. Yes?
The only thing I'm thinking of, are there any age limits as far as too young?
Well, I don't know. I've threatened to get a motorized tractor for Margie and me.
Oh!
Robert, what would happen? How young were you thinking? How young were you thinking? Wait a minute. How young were you thinking? 11? 11 and up? Or, yeah. There is another tour going over from Kansas sometime later in the year. They're not having anything to do with the Institute. But I would guess that what we ought to do is there's another reason for getting names in as soon as we could. I'm going to be especially considerate of families because... how old were we, Beth, when we began going out to some of these places?
Nine,
seven, and five. And they had a tremendous impact on the children at that age.
Did they have to? The thing I consider is that sitting
through those lectures, I think that would be a real struggle for things.
For children that age. Yeah. Yes. Yes, that's true.
The children need to be, also need to look after the children while the lectures are going on, because these are advanced lectures, which they do want the children to know.
And when you have an Irish scholar lecturing, that is something else. I don't know how he lectures. But those of you who know Dr. Wright know that he can get very close to his notes. And these men really have packed lectures. I will be pretty frivolous compared to them. I don't even know which of these I'll be speaking on. I'm confident that he'll be speaking on Henderson and the National Covenant and the Westminster Assembly and the Westminster Standards and George Gillespie. He'll be lecturing on some of those things, I know. Margie? Big pardon?
Are you going to be lecturing on Philippians 5, 6, 7?
That's just the theme that he's put together here. And he sent this over. I go back and say again. He sent this over as a trial balloon. This is the thing that holds it together, going through the book of Philippians. Margie?
When we took our children, it was sort of a family affair. And we could schedule time and places according to the needs of the children. We didn't have to worry about anybody else.
Yeah.
We could get as little or as much as we needed to meet that young age. But we were also learning for ourselves.
I'm guessing that there probably will be some who will go a week early and some who will stay a week late. Some who may not even want to be there for these lectures in this part of it. And that's fine. We'll do everything we can to help arrange that. And as we do the spade work on what the ticket costs are and other things like that, then I think that should be a real help to everyone. Whether or not Maranatha would be available for accommodations, I don't know. But a family, you see, can get into a bed and breakfast if we start working on it in time. All right, let that be just sort of a thing that salts the oats a little bit. And now let's go ahead to the subject of monasticism this evening. Oh, one other thing. Dr. Boyce will not be able, he needs time with his mother and his sister here in Indianapolis. They live here. So he will need time with them. He will not be able to speak to the students here on Friday evening at what time was that, 4:30? 4:30. The students who would have been, those of you who are looking forward to... Who do we say on that, Michael? Can you help me out on this announcement here? Who would then be invited to that banquet?
I have the list upstairs, but it's... do you want to go over that whole list of who's on?
I talked with Bud about that before, and let me know if you are particularly interested in being there. I mentioned you two men from Lafayette, and I mentioned Tom, and these men here. The banquet is limited, but Dr. Boyce just could not make that other meeting. And he does have a responsibility to his mother, and he does have very little opportunity to see her and his sister here in town. So he's having to forego this time here. With the seminarians. Do you want something, Mark? Go ahead. Okay. Mark has particular responsibility for a leaf rake that is not going to take place tomorrow morning. If you know anybody planning to come over, please let them know. The costs event will go on. Monasticism, and I thought it might be interesting to show you a picture of a monastery. I don't know very much about the terminology that's here. Do each one of you have one of these? This is a monastery. This is the building that we're talking about here now. The scriptorium library was where the monks learned to write and did writing. The other words you may know better than I do. The guest house, the school, the abbot's house. The abbot is the man in charge of the house itself. The kitchen, brew and work, bake house for guests. In the guest house, there were many guests that came through there. These were not motels, but they didn't have motels. And so it was these communities that housed people who were visiting, who were traveling. And the visiting monks were up here. The school and guest masters who were coming in to teach and to disciple were quartered here, and there were all kinds of rooms for teaching, and you could notice the barn, the threshing floor, and the chicken, and the caretakers, the shops, the press over here. It was a pretty self-contained community, and when we talked before about the community in Iona, and the community in all these other places. This is the kind of place that we're talking about. Now I want to go ahead and give you some definitions to begin with here this evening. The abbey was for either sex, one or the other. Monastery was a word that emphasized the loneliness of this life and community. The convent was the word that emphasized the association and the fellowship of it. The hermitage emphasized the single recluse, a collection of cells. Remember Luther... knew that. For either sex, the cloister was involved, the abbey, the convent could be either for the men or for the women, the priory were for either sex, cloister, abbey, convent, and priory were for either sex, either the men or the women. The friary, F-R-I-A-R-Y, was always for men. The nunnery was always for women. An abbey was always governed by an abbot, or in the case of women, an abbess. An abbey was always governed by an abbot or an abbess. And over a priory, it was governed by a prior or a prioress. If it was for women, then it was a prioress. If it was a man, then it was a prior. The word convent actually means a religious body, or a community or association of people. It could be men or women, monks or nuns. But it came to mean primarily women. So watch when you're reading, because you may find where they're talking about a convent. We always think of that as being women. But they may be talking about a convent, and that would be men only, having men only in it. And the cloister really was the covered walkway between two buildings. It was a sheltered place. The church very quickly got into the idea that the best way to teach humility was to humiliate people. and that has never worked. And to teach piety by insisting that people would dress the same with a gown and so forth, as it is still being done today, has just not worked. There are many, many proud people who are very proud because of their humility. Who was it? Who was the writer in London? Uriah Heep, who was so proud of his humility. And you do have to look out for that. Let's go ahead now with some of that terminology behind us. The two most powerful influences within the medieval church was monasticism and the papacy. We'll talk about the papacy later. Talking about monasticism now. In order to understand not only what happened in history, but why, we have to get into this kind of a study. On this subject, some would worship the church, and whatever she did, they would see only good in her. They would shut their eyes and disavow, disclaim, refuse to admit. Anything bad, seeing only good in her. Others would see only bad and refuse to see anything good in, for example, the subject of monasticism that we're going to look at tonight. But in this case, monasticism, it's especially hard because the evil and the good are so closely woven together. You just can't separate them. You can condemn the evil and commend the good, but you can't see where the one ends and the other begins. And there's much that we can learn from it today, because monasteries and convents were the training grounds for the church's outreach in the Middle Ages. How could the medieval church have done what she did without the monastery and the convents? The men and the women who went out to bring about the conversion of England and of Germany and of Scandinavia had been trained and discipled in these monasteries. The monasteries of Iona, of Svengali, the Benedictine Abbey in New Corby. There were other functions of the monasteries and convents. Who else during these years would have kept alive the fires of education and scholarship and schools? Who else would have done all the transcribing, the research of the scriptures? It was an absolutely essential factor during these medieval years. And the writing. Who else would have continued to preserve the art? Who else would have done the teaching? Who else would have taught the world that in the labor of the hands there is dignity, not degradation? The Benedictines, those monks, taught the world that it is a noble thing for a noble man to get his hands dirty in agriculture. That's not just for the peasants and the slaves, but it's for the noble men. And farming is closely connected to spiritual life and prayer and Bible reading. It's not beneath the Bible student to become involved in agriculture. Labor was redeemed from ignominy that it had fallen into. It's a desperately important thing because it came on the heels of the barbarian invasions and the barbarian conquests. The barbarians had driven men off the farms. Now the monks came in and began farming. And then every once in a while you'd find men complaining that the monks had picked out the best plots of land to farm. Whereas if the truth were known, those monks made that land best and most fertile because they learned the skills of fertilizing, how to grow the right crops, how to rotate the crops, and the laws of the land. So in the areas where they were, they did have the best crops. But it wasn't because they'd been best ground when they settled there. They made that ground best. But after all is said and done, everything that can be said about the debts that we owe to monasticism, we have to go on to point to a principle of Scripture that was being violated, at least prior to the time of Augustine, the separating of the thousands of men to live alone as men, and the separating off of thousands of women to live their lives alone. The monks on both the East and the West shared the sin of seeming to protest against the family and against marriage life as gross and secular, seeming to insist that holiness was somehow related to singleness and keeping men and women apart insofar as marriage was concerned. Christian testimony was injured by that. The hearts of parents were not turned towards children and grandchildren, and the hearts of children to the parents. And in the long run, it brought the curse that God had promised to all such influences in Malachi 4:6, the last verse of the Old Testament. In the long run, I fear that monasticism brought about that curse. But God was still building his church. In spite of all the evils of monasticism, and they were enormous, God was using the very wrath of men to make it a praise to himself. Let's go back for a few minutes just to talk about monasticism. It originated in Egypt, perhaps back about the time of Athanasius. It spread through the lands of Syria and Palestine. It was brought, probably by Athanasius himself, into the West, 298 to 373. The Patriarch of Alexander first resisted in the West, but later accepted it and endorsed it. And it came to have a greater influence in the West than it did in the East. Almost all of what I'm saying right now is prehistoric insofar as medieval is concerned. Yet I'm just getting a sort of a running jump, a running start to bring this up into medieval times. The monasticism shared in the confusion of the 5th and 6th centuries. It was first organized by a man named Nursia, N-U-R-S-I-A, Nursia, who died in 453, who developed a rule for the convent of Monte Cassino. And it was, that's in central Italy. And it was one of such practical good sense. This rule of Nursia's was of such practical good sense that it was adopted by all the other monasteries in the West. A rule is a form of conduct. This is how you will live when you move into this community, into this house. Michael and Mark can tell us about how you draw up a rule. What are the rules? If any of you wanted to come to live in 4800 North Michigan Road, you'd have to conform to the rule that these two men have drawn up here.
Are you calling this a monastery?
No. No. Touché. We'll go on to study this particular order a little bit later on. I'm not talking about 4800 North Michigan Road. I'm talking about the Order of Nursia a little bit later on. The Dominicans, 1170 to 1200, the Franciscans, 1180 to 1226, and then later the Jesuits, around 1530 or so. What we want to pick up with now is what followed after the death of Charles the Great, Charlemagne. Charles, 688 to 741, the grandfather of Charlemagne, Charles Martel, the hammer. Then came Charlemagne, 742. And incidentally, I'm just going to run through several of these Charleses to make sure that you're all confused. Because you'll find these Charleses coming up over and over again. Be careful of them. And this Charles, what charge is that? Well, the first thing you do is do what exactly what Tom or Russ does. Now, which Charles are you talking about? What were his years? What were the dates for the man? Charles Martel, 688 to 741, the grandfather of Charlemagne. He was called the Hammer, the Frankish ruler. Then Charlemagne, 742 to 814, Charles the Great, the king of the Franks, from 768 to 814, that's the latter part of his life, and the emperor of the West, from the year 800 to 814. You have to see how his biography progressed, because this is all the same man. In different years, he was emperor of the West. Before that, he was king of the Franks. Then he was Charles the Great even before that. Another Charles, the Fifth, called Charles the Wise, 1337 to 1380, was king of France from 1364 to 1380. He died as king of France. And then there's still another Charles V from 1500 to 1558, the emperor of Germany. From 1519, this man, Charles V, was emperor from 1519 to 1556 of Germany. And then there was Charles I of Spain, 1516 to 1556. He abdicated in 1556. And then there was Charles VII, 1403 to 1461. He was king of France, the latter part of his life, 1422 to the end of his life, 61, up to 61. And Charles IX, from 1550 to 1574, he was king of France from 1560 until 1574 when he died. And then there was Charles II, 1630 to 1685, king of England, from 1660 to 1685. So, the minute you run into the name Charles, which Charles is he talking about? You've got to run it back and make sure. And I just want to tell you how confusing it can get. Yeah?
Could I request that maybe that could be typed up or something for us next week?
That's yeah.
Real handy, the handout.
Sure. Let's do that. All right. Okay. We can do that, can't we? Heather, please. Right after the death of Charlemagne in 814, I've quit that monkey business now. I'm going back to the lecture. Right after the death of Charlemagne in 814, he had failed in his great plan to unify the entire world, to make it into a one world state and a one world church. Monasticism fell apart into new depths of degradation. But by the year 910, there were signs of revival. There was a new beginning that was being made in the world of monasticism in a monastery called Cluny, C-L-U-N-Y, or Clugny, C-L-U-G-N-Y, in 910 in central France, east central France, Burgundy. A new monastery there, Cluny. And every time matters in Rome were at a horrible state, there were men who were silently training who would bring in a new order of things. Hildebrand, they were going to be taking up a separate lecture, was one of those men. Gregory the Seventh, from 1015 to 1085. He was Pope from 1075 to 1085, those last 10 years. Hildebrand was one of these men. Other monasteries all over the known world identified with the changes that were going on in Cluny. And they banded together as a kind of congregation within the church itself. Like an imperio in imperio. A church within a church. The congregations of monasteries all over the known world. There was a similarity to them. And they played a very important part in the history of the church. By the middle of the 12th century, there were over 2,000 houses, as they were called. Congregations, I've called them. Sometimes they were called houses, instead of calling them monasteries. There were over 2,000 of these around through Europe. Now, that's an important factor. Many of these were in France. I started to say most of them were. And the abbot, or the archabbot of Cluny, was considered to be the Pope of monasticism. And with the single exception of the Pope himself, he was the most influential person in all of Christianity. For a time, he was even more pure and important than Monte Cassino, the ministry there at Cluny. More important than the Nursia, the place where it began, at Cassino. Yes. C-L-U-N-Y or C-L-U-G-N-Y. Spelled both ways. So watch for that one, because and you have to realize that we're back in medieval times, and the spelling of these words is shifts. You'll find that often, and don't be thrown by it. There's some names that are very similar, and you have to watch for them. But don't be thrown by the fact that the same name can be spelled different ways. They would be a kind, these congregations, or these houses, were a kind of religious guild or corporation. Camaldoli, C-A-M-A-L-D-O-L-I, D-O-L-I is the way that ends, were formed in 1018. The Vallombrosi, V-A-L-L-O-M-B-R-O-S-I, were formed in 1038. The Carthusian, strike a bell, Carthusians, C-A-R-T-H-U-S-I-A-N, were the most important. They were formed in 1084. The Carthusian rule, that is their form of conduct, was most severe and demanding of all. The law was seen by them as not merely a means to an end, but as an end in and of itself. The Carmelites, watch for these because you'll see these in 20th century news. The Carmelites were formed in 1156. The Carmelites tracked their history back to what prophets? Elijah and Elisha. Where? Mount Carmel. That was their headquarters, source, origin. Until the time when the Mohammedans captured it, the Turks captured it, and then they migrated to Europe. And it's important for you to watch. We'll talk about the east-west relationship between Byzantium, between Constantinople and Rome. We'll talk about that again in another lecture. But it's important for you to pick up these bits and pieces of how the Christianity of the East came to be in the West. When the Turks captured Mount Carmel, where their original headquarters were, then these monks moved to the west. The Cistercian Order, C-I-S-T-E-R-C-I-A-N, Cistercian Order, was formed in 1098. Their objective was to bring about a revival or a reformation within the walls of the church. They saw the need for a revival within the church. Their second objection, and this was an objective, and this was a new one, was to make monasticism into a quickening element for the multitudes who were outside the church. In other words, they had an evangelistic purpose. The Cistercians had an evangelistic purpose. They weren't just focused on preserving themselves and preserving the church, but they had a purpose that would go out beyond that. They anticipated the mendicants. This is a word you will want to know in the future, and you'll be seeing it. Mendicants. M-E-N-D-I-C-A-N-T-S. Mendicants. We'll talk about them and define them a little later. And this Cistercian order produced many prelates and cardinals and popes. The Cistercians were so severe and committed that they almost died out, almost killed themselves off. Their physical discipline was a terrible thing. But a young Burgundian noble named Bernard, watch for his name, Bernard, B-E-R-N-A-R-D, came in with 30-some young friends of his. These are just young single guys who were on fire for the love of a life that had rigorous discipline in it. And for over 25 years, Bernard ruled that order from Clerval, France. I'm not sure my French pronunciation, but C-L-A-I-R-V-A-U-X. Clairvaux?
Clairvaux.
Clairvaux, thank you. France. These people were counselors and rebukers. Bernard and his bin were trained. They became counselors to kings, a number of kings, and rebukers of kings. And they trained and elected popes. They were a healer of schisms. And they were a condemner of heresies. And most important, the most important personalities and the best in medieval monasticism. But Bernard himself was not a theologian. Now, I want to call your attention to an interesting sequence of events. This is important for you to catch it. The Clunians, that order, had been in existence for 200 years when the Cistercians were formed. The world admired the Clunians. They gave money and land and houses to them. Second step. There is no record of any great scandals or embezzlements among these Clunians. But gradually, the Clunian rule was relaxed, and they began to build beautiful, beautiful cathedrals, beautiful and expensive. No one ever intended that the new Cistercian order would become a rebuke to the older Clunian order. But here's the third step. When people began to compare the simplicity of the stark stone walls of the young Cistercians with the tapestries of the older Clunians, the vaulted ceilings of the Clunian cathedrals with the low, narrow doors and hallways of the Cistercian houses, the gold candelabra of the old Clunians with the iron candlesticks of the young Cistercians, the simple rituals and the chants of the Cistercians, with the elaborate processions and chants and music of the old Clunians, it became a silent rebuke to the old order. The fourth step then, somehow or other, the gold and the glory of Clugny gave way to the poverty and spirituality of the Cistercians. But then, and this is the next step, in due process, due time, the same thing began to happen to the Cistercians. The world favored them, and it became the kiss of death. So by the 13th century, the mission to the souls of men beyond their monastery had been taken away from them. And the mendicants began taking over from the Cistercians. And we'll talk about the mendicants a little bit later in another lecture. Goethe said this, "When a man has done a remarkable thing, the world takes excellent care that he shall never do another." And it applies to churches today, as well as to individuals. And if those of you from Second Reformed Presbyterian remember hearing something of this when we began talking about building a new building, and I'm thankful and proud of the new building. I'm not complaining about that. I'm thankful of it. But I am saying if we ever begin putting our confidence in the new building, then we're on this same slide. And if we ever forget to reach out beyond ourselves, we're on this same slide. I do not think that it is by any accident that God put it in the heart of Rich Johnston to begin working with Evangelism Explosion at almost exactly the same time that we moved into the new part out here. If we ever come to the place of preserving our own existence and feathering our own nest. He that loseth his life for my sake shall find it, Jesus said. And in medieval history, we see that. In all of this, the monastic orders were loved and protected and provided for by the papacy. The church could not have existed without her bishops and her pastors, but it was not from them that she got her best help and support. It was from the monastic orders. There was more real work done by the monks and the nuns. They were more available for a mission, flexible for emergency. When Gregory the First wanted a team to go into Britain, of course, he chose Augustine, who was the abbot of that abbey right there in Rome, and sent him with 40 others into Britain. And this was the availability of the troops to go across country and to move wherever God wanted them to go. And a good safety value for dangerous enthusiasm, instead of a safety valve, I mean, for enthusiasm, instead of wrecking the church, blowing the lid off, or blowing the sides out, the people who were really determined to go ahead were allowed to go ahead and form these orders and to develop a discipline and to develop further ministry. If the church had tried to keep the lid on this, it would have been blown apart. They provided a refuge and a retreat for men and women who were discouraged and disappointed, misunderstood, with lots of energy, and yet men and women who were fighting the battle of life and in danger of losing it. They took those men and women in, and they discipled them. They became spiritual disciples. They gave them a mission, a purpose for living that was more important, that was worth dying for. But they did it at a terrible price, because they turned the children against the parents and the parents against the children. And those of you who are reading the biographies of some of these men that we're going to be talking about later on, especially as we talk about the Dominicans and the Jesuits and the others, you will see over and over again where their parents were grieved and torn because their children insisted upon going into these convents and monasteries. Now, I want to go on into the subject of the papacy. When do we usually take a break? Yeah.
I have a question.
Yes.
You can take a wrench and you can pound a nail and you can get the job done. I think most mechanics would put up a pretty good argument. It's not really the best tool for the job. Isn't there a sense in which these monasteries and convents are the same thing? I mean, yes, they bring a lot of good, but they're not really God's best tool for the job.
Well, God's best tool for the job, it seems to me, was what Jesus himself did with the disciples. I'm afraid to go any further.
Well, Sharp and others defend the good that comes from monasteries, and we can't deny that the nail got pounded in.
The nail got pounded in. That's a good way of putting it, though.
But was it the best way, was it God's way?
Well, was it God's way? Do you see a tie-in as to why I read the scripture I read at the beginning this evening? Were kings God's way, or was it something that he permitted?
Right, the issue, and this might help, because the issue of the kings was timing. If they'd only waited for David, God was bringing kings, but they wanted one now, and if they'd waited, they could have had one. David would have been the right kind of king, and done it the way they said Deuteronomy to do it. And in the case of the monks, maybe there was something to get through that medieval period. God's work, but their way, at least to a great extent. They weren't looking to Scripture. Okay, God, if you want to have monasteries, what does the Bible say? It says man and woman should get married, first of all, so that had to be rearranged. But some of the other things might, if they've gone ahead, there might not have been wrong. There's other aspects of it. To keep the scriptures, to preserve the learning, those kinds of things are all scriptural basis, or many ways to work.
Russ's opening statement there before you turned around to begin listening was that it was the timing. That God intended kings, but they wanted the king right now, and they wanted it for a dishonorable purpose. They wanted it in order to be like the Joneses, to be like the other nations around us, not as a means of learning about God's lordship and his kingship. But they were discouraged with Samuel's children, his sons, and it was a reaction to that. But God permitted it. And then, in his providence, he overruled the hatred and rebellion of men by teaching them about the kingship of his son through these other kings. If they had waited, I'm sure that God would have brought up some of the kind. But I don't have all the answers about what would have happened if these monasteries had not developed. I'm sure that this was not God's first purpose, first way.